welcome to the June 2007 edition of Hot Type, Security Books and Audio, brought to you by CertSecurity.com and Addison Wesley. I'm Billy Hurley. As always, our Hot Type podcasts bring you free excerpts from recently published information security books, read by the authors themselves. Today's featured author is Chris Y. Sopel, co-founder and chief technology officer of security firm Veracode. Y. Sopel is a founder of the Organization for Internet Safety, an industry group that has published guidelines for responsible vulnerability disclosure. While vice president of research and development for security consultancy At Stake, he provided expert testimony before Congress on the subject of vulnerability research. Y. Sopel is one of four authors that contributed to the book The Art of Software Security Testing, Identifying Software Security Flaws. The book, available from Addison Wesley, explores the many design flaws and coding vulnerabilities that can arise in software. The authors explain what software designers can do to find and address these common security bugs. And now, reading a selection from Chapter 2, How Vulnerabilities Get Into All Software, here's Chris Y. Sopel.
Chapter 2, How Vulnerabilities Get Into All Software. Expert software security testers know that all software has latent vulnerabilities. Given enough time, there isn't a non-trivial program in which they couldn't find security bugs. Yet most software developers are highly skeptical that there are any security problems in their software. Understanding how the deck is stacked heavily against the developer can open your eyes to the many root causes of security bugs you are looking for. It also can change your mindset from one where software is presumed to be secure to one where security must be proven. For example, consider a list circulating among programmers on the internet that tracks the stages of fixing a software bug as the programmer progresses from denial to enlightenment to skepticism. 1. That can't happen. 2. That doesn't happen on my machine. 3. That shouldn't happen. 4. Why does that happen? 5. Oh, I see. 6. How did that ever work? This chapter answers question 4, why does that happen? It also provides the answer for a 7th stage of debugging, 7, how can this be prevented in the future? Here we cover the range of things that can go wrong during the software development process, from the lack of security requirements to the lack of secure development practices, such as using an improper variable to store a particular value such as a buffer size. If your software is not designed with security in mind, it will be difficult or nearly impossible to make it secure later. On the other hand, secure design cannot protect or mitigate all implementation flaws. So even if the design is a masterpiece, the implementation details still matter. Secure coding standards must be adhered to, and the implementation must be tested. Common secure design issues. Poor use of cryptography. Cryptography is an essential technique for creating secure systems. When two parties communicate over an insecure channel, such as the internet, and eavesdropping is a threat, cryptography can be used to mitigate that threat. When a system needs to authenticate a user, cryptography can be used to securely store a password or token. When session management is required to maintain state over a stateless protocol, such as HTTP, cryptography can enable the session to be securely maintained. Unfortunately, cryptography is a complex technology filled with pitfalls. Three common pitfalls are described next. Creating your own cryptography. Creating a strong crypto algorithm is very difficult. It takes years of training and research. Even implementing a known good crypto algorithm, such as AES or Blowfish, is very difficult to do correctly. Just because an implementation interoperates with another known good one does not mean it is correct from a security standpoint. The same thing goes for creating your own crypto protocol handshakes. You should always use a known good crypto library, such as Microsoft's Crypto API or OpenSSL. These libraries have undergone rigorous testing and are constantly tested for weaknesses. By using them, you get the benefit of the expertise that went into creating them, and all the effort that has gone into testing them. Choosing the wrong cryptography. Whole books have been written on cryptography, so it is advisable to read up on the subject before deciding if an algorithm is suitable for your security needs. In general, using FIPS-approved algorithms is a good idea. They have been heavily vetted by the crypto community, and there is one of every type of algorithm you would need. Two major types of cryptography are symmetric and public key. Within symmetric are block ciphers and stream ciphers. Block ciphers require you to select a mode of operation. This topic is beyond the scope of this book, but you should educate yourself on symmetric cryptography before implementing it. Symmetric ciphers require a fixed secret key for both sender and receiver, so key management becomes an issue. Public key cryptography allows both the sender and receiver to have their own key. This is what is used in the ubiquitous SSL along with symmetric encryption. Cryptographic hash functions and message authentication codes are better suited for security mechanisms to detect tampering or to sign a message. Relying on security by obscurity. Security by obscurity is a tempting thing for programmers to rely on. It works only if one tries hard enough to break through the security. If it is done really well, it can remain secure for some length of time. The problem is that the length of time is under the attacker's control. If the attacker expends enough resources, even the best security by obscurity will fail. Hard-coded secrets. One of the fundamental tenets of cryptography is that secrets must remain secret or the crypto system fails to work. What good is a password if you write it down and post it on the outside of your laptop? The same goes for secrets that a program uses to store or transmit data securely. Many programs have a requirement that data must be stored securely on disk or in a database. They may also have requirements that data must be transmitted in an encrypted form between client and server or different application components. Building crypto systems is difficult. Unless you have many years of cryptography under your belt, it's almost impossible to write your own secure encryption algorithm. Even using off-the-shelf cryptography can be difficult. One of the most challenging parts of cryptography is key management. That's where hard-coded secrets come in. Key management is the process of installing and moving around the secret keys that make the crypto system work. Programmers often miss this critical factor or just don't have enough time to do it right. So they hard code a secret key as a static value in the application and then try to obfuscate it with XOR encoding or other binary math. But the fact remains that a hard coded secret is available to anyone who gets his hands on the source code or the compiled binary. After a small amount of reverse engineering, an attacker can decrypt data stored by the application or encrypted data sniffed on the network. A good rule of thumb is that if you have a hard-coded secret key in your application, you need to treat the entire application as a secret. This obviously cannot work for applications distributed to a large number of users. They will all know the other users' keys. This is the reason that people say digital rights management, or DRM, is fundamentally flawed. A type of cryptography called public key cryptography uses public keys that can be widely distributed. If a key needs to be embedded in software, a public key should be used. Mishandling private information. Private information is data that the application should not disclose to anyone but users authorized to access it. Secrets such as passwords, password hashes, crypto keys, and session identifiers are critical to not disclose because their disclosure usually breaks the system's security. Other private data, such as account names, credit card numbers, and account balances, often is very important to keep private. You should review the value of the system's data assets and design the system such that other valuable information is not disclosed. Proper handling of private information is to not let the information be written to temporary files, log files, or swap disk inadvertently. Buffers that are used to hold private data should be zeroed out so that if the system reuses memory for another user's session, he won't be able to view the data. If data is written to a file or stored in a database, it should be encrypted. If the system's security is breached, the attacker won't be able to recover the private information in clear text. Tracking users and their permissions. Many networked applications need to track which user is associated with the transaction so that the application can perform an authorization step before the transaction will complete. If the user is not authorized for a particular transaction or the data the transaction will operate on, the application must return an error. Weak or missing session management. After a session is created for a user, it must be managed. This is typically done by assigning a non-guessable, non-predictable session identifier to the session and storing it in a cookie for web applications. A cryptographic hash should be used. If a simple incrementing number or timestamp is used, the attacker can guess a valid session identifier and use another user's already authenticated session. Session identifiers must also be sent over the network encrypted using something like SSL. If an attacker can sniff the network or put a man-in-the-middle attack into effect, the attacker can access another user's session identifier. The application must also be free of cross-site scripting vulnerabilities because they can be used to steal cookies from a user. Weak or missing authentication. Authentication must be secure because authorization relies on it. Passwords must be sent from the user to the system over a secure connection such as SSL so that they are not intercepted. The authentication step should not be able to be bypassed. Password quality should be enforced, and an attacker should not be able to try more than 3 passwords before the system starts slowing down. This can prevent a brute force attack. Weak or missing authorization. Authorization is typically difficult for many applications to implement correctly. There should be no way for an attacker to bypass the authorization step and perform a transaction with the system that they would otherwise not be authorized to do. Flawed input validation. Missing or flawed input validation is the number one cause of many of the most severe vulnerabilities. These include buffer overflows, SQL injection, and cross-site scripting. Input validation is critical to get correct. You should spend time reviewing the validation routines and testing them for correctness. Not performing validation in a secure context, such as on the server and not on a client. Many client-server applications perform data validation on the client side to improve performance. If the user enters erroneous data, it is quicker to validate the data before sending it over the network and requiring the server to do it. This is a good reason to validate data on the client side. But if this is the only validation, an attacker can easily bypass this step by turning off the code the client validation is done in, such as JavaScript. He can use a custom web client or a web proxy that can manipulate the client data without the client validation code running. Not centralizing validation routines. Validation routines are not easy to write. Many validation routines at different levels within the program can cause complexities that are hard to review for correctness. Input validation should be performed as close to the user input as possible, and should be centralized so that you can verify that all data is passing through the validation routines and that they are correct. It should be noted that sometimes simply centralizing disparate validation routines causes oversimplified validation routines that end up being insufficient. Care must be taken to maintain strict validation while centralizing the flow of external data through a validator. Not securing component boundaries. Most software today is built with multiple components. A chart control is an example of a component, as is a database object that is used to interface with a database server. These are off-the-shelf objects that are supplied by component or server vendors. Developers often split their own code into components so that they can be reused by other software projects or can be used to simplify communication within their program. For example, an application server may have a configuration component that an administrator uses to configure the software that is a separate process. This component can communicate with the main application server engine or inter-process communication, such as a named pipe. Component boundaries are the points of a program where components communicate with each other. Communication is typically over a TCP/IP socket, a name pipe, a file, shared memory, or through remote procedure calls. Unless this communication channel is authenticated, all the data that is interchanged between components is potentially hostile because the communication channel is susceptible to the injection of hostile data. Coupled with the fact that many component interfaces assume that the data has already been validated, this makes component boundary vulnerabilities waiting to happen. Validation should be performed at each component boundary. This is commonly called defensive programming. More component boundaries mean more input points that must be validated correctly, and more chances for the programmer to make an error. Weak structural security. Large attack surface. The attack surface is the boundary of an application that an attacker can potentially interact with. For most applications, this is the interface it has to the network, but it can also be the file system, the registry, or inter-process communication. The more ways the application communicates with the outside world, the larger the attack surface. An application listening to the network on two ports is typically less secure than an application listening on one. It isn't just the quantity of the attack surface, but how it is implemented. The attack surface is larger for programs that perform more processing on data input before performing security functions such as authentication, authorization, or input validation. A large amount of parsing or performing computation on the data before these security functions are performed means more code that can contain vulnerabilities that an attacker has access to. Running a process at too high a privilege level. When a vulnerability is exploited, the attacker's actions, whether executing arbitrary code or manipulating the system's file system, are performed with the privileges of the running process. This is why attackers strive to exploit software running at the highest level, root on Unix and administrator or system on Windows. Running at the lowest possible privilege level to accomplish what the software needs limits the damage caused if a vulnerability is exploited. A good example of running at a low privilege level is the Apache web server. It runs as the nobody user on Unix. The Apache configuration log files are configured to not allow the user nobody to modify them. The nobody user cannot write to any of the web content on the system. The result of this good design is that when a security vulnerability is exploited, the attacker cannot modify how the web server is running or change its content. No defense in depth. A fundamental tenet of secure design is to not rely on one mechanism to achieve security because that mechanism may fail. Multiple independent security mechanisms should be employed. A real-world example of defense in depth is a bank's physical security. The vault doesn't open onto the street. The bank has a front door with a lock, an interior door with a lock, and then finally the vault door. Each door has a security camera on it. Each door has an alarm on it. There are also likely to be motion sensors in the rooms between the doors. Any one of these security mechanisms can fail, yet the entire security system still mitigates the risk of a bank heist. When designing mitigations against threats to an application, designers should use multiple mechanisms to counter the threat. For the threat of SQL injection, designers should use input filtering to make sure the data that may end up as part of a SQL query is well-formed. They should also use stored prepared statements that bind variables for all queries. Sensitive data should be encrypted so that if an attacker gets access to the system, he also needs the correct key. Transactions should be logged with an IP address and, if possible, a username associated with them. Every mitigation you put in your software will have limitations. It could also have bugs. If you use defense in depth, your software will remain secure in the face of a failing mitigation. Not failing securely. Unless an attacker has stolen identity credentials, it is likely that he is trying to get the application to do something its design does not intend it to do. A major source of unintended functionality is error handling code. It is often inadequately designed and tested. As a security tester, you will stress the error handling code because most of your inputs to the program will attempt to get the program to not perform its intended functionality. Unless the program recovers gracefully from any and all input, an attacker may be able to use the functionality in the error handling routine to alter the program's execution. An additional error handling problem is how to report an error condition without disclosing to an attacker information about the system that he can use to direct his attack. Often error messages contain stack traces, directory information, and version information for software components and services the software connects to. The software should log details to a log file that an administrator can read and simply tell the user there was an error. Other design flaws: mixing code and data. Multi-tier applications offer transfer commands and other interpreted code from one process to another. If an attacker can find a way to modify this code, he will have found a way to modify the application's execution. A common example is a web application server that sends JavaScript code to a web client to perform client-side rendering or validation. Another example is an application server that sends SQL queries to a database server. SQL is a programming language that is executed by the database server. The application design should isolate the data supplied by users from the code that the application transmits to other systems or executes itself. This is simple if the code is static, but often this code is generated using user data. If this is the case, care must be taken to sanitize the user data so that an attacker cannot modify the generated code and thus control execution of part of the system. Misplaced trust in external systems. Every data input into an application is a potential hazard. It is often obvious to software designers that they need to be wary of the data input by users. However, these designers often forget that they should be wary of all data external to the application. This may come from the old notion that human input can be erroneous, so it must be made bulletproof, but input from other processes and systems is generated by a computer, so it is well-formed and safe. This false sense of security assumes that no malicious actors are spoofing external systems or compromising them. When that is the case, the input vectors to an application from the external system are just as dangerous as user input. All external input must be treated as dangerous. It must be sanitized of harmful data. Even with sanitized data, care must be taken not to put any unwarranted trust in the data. The external system should be authenticated if possible. For anonymously accessed external systems, such as domain name servers, the data should not be relied on to make any security decisions. The data is useful for logging, but an attacker should not be able to leverage control of an external server to get an application to make a different security decision. In a multi-tier system where the application is running across many servers, each server should authenticate the other, and if practical, use encryption to thwart impersonation and man-in-the-middle attacks. In an impersonation attack, the attacker replaces a server with one that looks like the original, but the attacker controls the new server. This attack can be performed by modifying the domain name system used or at the network layer. Man-in-the-middle is similar to impersonation, but uses a proxy to modify just the data required to effect an attack. Insecure defaults. An application should always default to a secure operating mode. It should not require configuration change out of the box to be made secure, because this change will often be forgotten or performed improperly. Attackers target insecure default configurations because they know many systems are deployed that way. Missing audit logs. Audit logs are an essential component of a secure application. They enable attacks to be detected.
That was author Chris Y. Sopel, co-founder and CTO of security firm Veracode, reading a selection from his book, The Art of Software Security Testing, published by Addison Wesley. Listeners to this podcast are eligible to purchase the book at a special discounted rate. To learn more and to check out our other information security podcasts, visit our podcast page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. I'm Billy Hurley. Thanks for listening.